watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
July 4th, 1776. After declaring equality, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness inalienable human rights, insurgent colonists who would not be governed against their will took up arms against King George, who they called a tyrant. They called themselves patriots. King George and his men called them criminals. Though the patriots won their war, they abandoned the ideals of the Declaration of July 4th as they set up a nation in which 90% of the people in it were slaves, chattel slaves, marital slaves, or debt slaves. Since then, many have fought and even died for those inalienable rights, but they have not been called patriots. They have been called criminals, and some are rotting in jail right now. On the celebration of the Declaration's 230th birthday, we'll present some reportage on the doings of patriots and criminals. You decide which are which. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. Last month, Iraq war resistors and their supporters gathered in Buffalo, New York, and Fort Erie, Ontario, to benefit U.S. military war resistors who have taken refuge in Canada rather than be deployed to Iraq. Following the footsteps of Vietnam war resistors, they're finding that the Canadian laws are far less welcoming than a generation ago. Here are some of their voices.
My name is Ryan Johnson. I was private second class of the U.S. Army. I was stationed in Fort Irwin, California in the 211th ACR. I joined the military in November of 2003. I started basic in March of 2004. And I joined as supply. I was told that that's a non-combat job, so the likelihood of me seeing combat was very low, and I was told that I wouldn't be going to combat anyway because I'd requested it when I went to the recruiter. I got to my unit in September of 2004. Shortly after my arrival in my unit, I found out that I was deploying to Iraq. I told my first sergeant, my commander, that I was told on recruitment that I wouldn't be deploying. And they told me that I was lied to by the recruiters. It's fairly standard practice for that to happen. And I'm going to deploy with my unit. There's no way for me to get out of it. Shortly after that, they actually put us all in formation and told us that we could apply for conscientious objector status if we do not want to deploy. However, we would all be denied because every one of us is going to fight in Iraq. My first day in basic training, our drill sergeant sat our entire platoon down and said, "I don't want to hear what your recruiter said because it was mostly bullshit. I don't want to hear you say, well, my recruiter said this, my recruiter said that. You're in the Army now, and you're going to do what we say. You're going to deploy if that's what needs to be done." And most of us weren't activists before we were in the military or while we were in the military, so now being an activist and being interviewed, it's quite a change for people.
Why'd you join?
I was from a small agricultural town in California. My family didn't have money to send me to college. I dropped out of high school when I was 17. Never had health care, never had dental, no hopes of going to college, and all I was working was, you know, short-term $6.75 an hour jobs. Saw an advertisement for the U.S. military. I knew that they gave health care and there's a way to college, constant pay. Can't really get fired unless you do something very stupid. Especially in a time of war, they don't really just let people out of the military. So I figured it would be a secure job option for me. And when I was told that I wouldn't have to deploy to serve my country, it sealed the deal for me. I was pretty excited about it. That's basically how I joined. I just wanted to have a better life for myself and my wife. Well, just to bring out a point about the healthcare and the dental care in the military. When I was in training, I had a fall, and when I went to the hospital for it, they had me lay down and they felt my back and told me I had pulled muscles in my back. I had been going to the hospital regularly because I'd been having constant pain in my back, and they just kept giving me Tylenol 3, Percocet, you're going to be fine, it's going to heal. 5 months after that, I got a case of pneumonia, and they did an x-ray on my chest to see how much fluid was in my lungs. And they realized that I had 2 fractured vertebrae in my spine. And this was 2 or 3 months before deployment, and I brought it up, what's going to happen? I can't really deploy with a fractured back. I've been complaining about this pain for some time. And they said, we could put you in physical therapy and everything, but there's no time for that right now. You'll have to do it when you return from Iraq. So I was pretty shocked to hear that. I started thinking, what's going to happen when I get over there and get my arm blown off? Are they just going to bandage it up and send me home and say, oh, well, I'm sorry? I was considered Class 3. I'd never had dental coverage before. So Class 3 means that before you can deploy, they have to fix the problem. The way that they fix the problem is they pull your teeth. I had 9 teeth removed in the military. And the way that they remove teeth in the military, it's unlike the civilian world. My mother had a tooth removed, and they cut open the gum and they remove the tooth. The way they remove my teeth is they stick an instrument that looks similar to a screwdriver in the cavity area, and they apply pressure and twist it until the tooth shatters, and they remove the tooth with forceps. They removed 9 teeth in that manner, broke my jaw twice doing it. When they pulled out the tooth, there was actually a piece of my jaw the size of a dime or a nickel attached to it, because they, teeth aren't exactly meant to be grabbed and twisted until they break out. So I don't have any back teeth, really, so eating is a bit difficult for me. Finally, I got fed up with it, and I told them they're not pulling any more of my teeth out, and I want them to fill it. I had 3 teeth filled from that point, and all of them had fallen out within a year of me leaving the military. That's it's the magic of the free dental and health care that the United States government pays, millions of dollars to give these soldiers. Instead of deploying, I went AWOL. I was AWOL in the United States for 5 months before I came to Canada.
Was that difficult to do?
It was extremely difficult because I was afraid to work because there's a federal warrant for my arrest. So if they run my social security number, it's going to pop that I have a federal warrant. So if it shows that there's someone running my social security number in Tacoma, Washington, they're going to know where I'm at. I was afraid to drive because they had my license plate number. And if somebody checks my license plate, there's a federal warrant. They'll pull me over and they'll remove me from the car and arrest me. I'll be sent to a military facility where I'll await court-martial. It was a very stressful time for me and my wife because I didn't know if she could go to jail for aiding desertion. I had talked to my family. I was worried that they could go to jail for aiding desertion. It was a very stressful time.
Any advice for people who may or may be in that position or thinking about it?
Call the GI Rights Hotline. GI Rights Hotline. They'll give you any information you need as to what's going to happen, whether you get arrested or you go to Canada, or you're just going to hide out in the States. They'll have all the information that you need to have.
And do they rat you out?
No.
Like this guy called and asked about these things?
No, they're...
How do you know that?
Because I called them. I spoke with the GI Rights Hotline before I went AWOL, and they didn't tell me that I should go AWOL or desert, but they told me what's going to happen. They knew my name, they had my information, and they checked to see if there was a federal warrant for my arrest. for me, so that I knew when I was dropped from the rolls. They told me what information I need. At the time, they didn't have very much information on Canada because there wasn't much information on Canada available. But now they have all the information. I'm in contact with my counselor from the GI Rights Hotline pretty frequently. She's actually the person that introduced me to Cindy Sheehan in California. I knew Cindy before I came to Canada. And they don't write you out. They're an independent group that helps soldiers, not just when they're AWOL, but when they get back from Iraq, they'll help them find like real mental health people, because the mental health that people get while they're in the military from the military is just as poor as the health care and dental care. I've been talking to soldiers that have just gotten back from my unit, and it's been very brief care, if any.
What are those guys saying?
My buddy's back. They're mostly supportive of me for coming to Canada. Many of them say that if they are faced with redeployment, they won't go back. They'll do anything they can not to go back, including come to Canada. This choice isn't really for everybody. There's no guarantee that we'll be able to stay here. Really, if you come here, the best option is to apply for refugee status, because if you are stopped for any reason by the police without refugee paperwork, you will be deported immediately. It nearly happened to me. However, I had my refugee paperwork. And they were still wanting to deport me, the police were. But it's a hard decision to make. You don't get to see your family very often. You're in a place that you're not very familiar with unless you lived near the border of Canada and you're able to come here frequently.
Hello, everybody. My name is Christian Kerr. I am a United States Marine, private first class. My job in the Marine Corps was military police. I just came up to Canada, October 17th, and I've been up here about 8 months now. So far, so good.
Well, I joined right after high school. I really didn't have too much going for me. 12 years of school just came to an end, and after that, I was kind of just sitting on my ass doing nothing. And I was working, I think, part-time in a comic book store and part-time in a pizza place. So I really didn't have money for school either, and my family didn't have... Really, they could have helped, but it wouldn't have been enough, because education is ridiculously expensive in the States. I think I looked into it at one point, it would have cost me $35,000 a year or something. There's no way that I could have afforded that. No way at all. The military offered me, the GI Bill, $110,000 for college after 4 years of 4 or 5 years of honorable duty, and then, what is it, free college while in the military. The only thing I would have to pay for is my books. But, they've promised the world, but it's not delivered to you. Especially when you're training for war. You're up at the crack of dawn, and sleep late at night, training all day. No time for school. No time. Three hots and a cot. I needed to get my life in gear, and it really appeared to me at the time, and the way that the Marine Corps was being sold to me, that it was the best option, the greatest thing that I could have done in my life, But when you're living, breathing, training, and willing to fight a war, and your mentality begins to change from that of not wanting to take life to where being trained, to where it's, I don't know, at the end of boot camp, I felt that it would have been easier to take somebody's life than it would have been to shoot a deer or something like that. And that's, I didn't really like feeling that way. I started questioning where my values lay, and I think they lay up here in Canada. If you have any doubt in your mind whether or not you want to kill people, then just start questioning yourself, question everything, question authority, question the people who are giving you the orders, because they're not always acting with the omnipotence that they feel that they are acting upon. Coming to Canada has been the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. I've left everything behind. Family, friends, my identity as a Marine and as an American. Something that I both, I felt proud to be. But I don't know what it was that kind of crushed that divine intervention, I hope, maybe. Kind of crushed that image, but I don't know. I feel definitely a little bit more of a humbled man.
This said, I grew up right over here in Buffalo, so, you know, this is kind of like my old stomping grounds. Fort Erie, coming up here and losing my money at the casinos and the racetracks.
When I got out of the Army in 95, I was proud that what I was doing was making a difference, you know, and when I enlisted in 2000, I thought the same thing, you know. I was going to be, you know, doing something good. Go USA, America's the good guys. But that quickly changed after 9/11, and you know, I could, in my mind, I could rationalize Afghanistan, but Iraq, I could never rationalize that. I still re-enlisted in 2004 for another 3 years. My son, he's 4 years old. He has a seizure disorder, and. As Americans know, you know, the healthcare system in the States is not free. You have to have money to pay for your healthcare, and if you have pre-existing conditions, they take that into effect. I didn't. There was no way I could get out of the Army and get immediate healthcare coverage for my son. The only other option that I could think of was coming to Canada. So that, and a combination of other things, younger soldiers coming up to me saying, hey, Sergeant Hart, you know, what's it like in Iraq? You know, what are we going to do over there? I've got pictures of, and video footage of stuff that would give each and every one of you here nightmares. And I don't, I when I was getting ready to go back to Iraq, I forced myself to watch these horrific images and videos for the simple fact that I was trying to put on my game face to turn myself into like a monster, because if I go there, I'm not going to be the victim. I'm going to be the one, you know, doing the killing. But that's not me. That's not my personality. And the Army expects everyone, all the soldiers, to be able to turn it on and turn it off just like that. And you know what happens when you create this beast? The soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, from 82nd Airborne Division, killing their wives. There was like five or six instances after the first rotation of troops started coming back and going back to Fort Bragg. Where the soldiers were coming back, brutalizing their wives, killing themselves. I've had friends in the Army that have committed suicide, and they didn't see any action. War changes you. It changes everybody, whether you're the man on the front line, whether you're the man sitting in the desert in Kuwait looking out into nothing. It changes you, and it changed me. And I'm just, you know, trying to get back to being the person that I was before I went in the Army. It's the obligation of every American to lay down their weapon and disobey the laws of the state when acts of atrocities are being committed over in Iraq and in Afghanistan. It's your duty as a soldier to lay down your weapons as per the Nuremberg trials. Because if you're just following orders, then you're no better than the Nazis were in Germany during the 40s. When I deserted, the Army tells everyone it's about family values, about loyalty and honor and duty and respect and selfless service. Jill has a very very good tale as to how honorable and selfless the U.S. Army was to her.
When my husband joined the Army, I had no idea what I was in for. I decided when we got to our first duty station together, Fort Riley, Kansas, that I was going to become the super wife. I was going to get involved in every way that I possibly could so that I could make this time that my husband served as easy as possible. I became what is called the Family Readiness Group Leader, which means I was the conduit between the military and the civilian family members. I continued this when we PCS'd to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and last summer, I was preparing people, family members, for the deployment to Iraq. Excuse me. The military tells you that they are all about family values in the family unit itself, and I can tell you that that is a lie. When my husband decided to go AWOL, he was on a weekend pass to Buffalo, New York, to see a football game. He told me it was the last game that he'd see before he went to Iraq. It was also my birthday. I had to stay on Fort Campbell because I had a casualty notification seminar to attend. On the day that I was to pick my husband up from the bus station, he called me a few hours before and said, "Honey, don't pick me up." And I said, "Oh, are you delayed?" And he said, "No, I'm with friends and I'm not coming home." And he hung up. I had absolutely no idea what was going on. Everything was running through my mind. I thought, maybe he got Ozfest tickets. Maybe it's a surprise. It took me about 24 hours to realize that I had assumed that he was in Canada. And from then on, it took about two or three days before I talked to him again. During this time, I stayed true to my Army values. I let the commander know that my husband wasn't coming home. I didn't know where he was. Every time I got an email, I forwarded it to the command. Every time I got a phone call, I called the commander and first sergeant to let them know. I was not going to support a soldier going AWOL. I did not understand. On the day that my husband was declared AWOL, every single non-commissioned officer in his unit called my house to remind me that my husband was AWOL. I had a conversation with our company commander, and mind you, the days prior to this, he was like, "Oh, he's a fantastic non-commissioned officer. He's great. He'll be back. Something must have happened. Don't worry about it, Mrs. Hart. Don't worry about it." So when it finally became he was actually AWOL, the conversation then changed. The commander called me and said, "How do you think we can get that piece of dog shit back here?" And I told the commander, while he may be a piece of dog shit at this time, you are not allowed to call him that. Only I am allowed to call him that. The commander then said, "The next time you talk to your husband, let him know that we're going to shut off your TRICARE benefit. That's our military health insurance." I said, "Why would he care about that?" And the commander responded by saying, "Well, I hope Ryan, my son, doesn't have another seizure." He then went on to say that he had friends at Blanchfield Community Hospital on base that could arrange it so that my husband was contacted in Canada and told that I was so severely sexually assaulted that he needed to come back to the United States to take custody of our son. It was at that time when I said, "Sir, this conversation is over." I dedicated 6 years to helping families in the military deal with the military, and I never expected the military to turn on me when my husband went AWOL. I thought the military considered us as two separate entities. And the fact of the matter is that the Army only cares about the soldier that can go like this. They don't care about the families, the wives, the husbands, or the children, specifically the children. They just want to know that the money that they've spent training these soldiers to fight is going to good use. So I'm very happy that I made the decision to come to Canada. I'm extremely proud of my husband and proud of all these men and women standing behind me today. And I thank you very much.
Daryl Anderson out of originally Southern California, but by way of Lexington, Kentucky. Stationed in Gießen, Germany, 1st Armored Division, 2-3 Field Artillery. Deployed to Baghdad, Iraq, January of 04 to July of 04. I was injured in combat. I received a Purple Heart for my wounds from a roadside bomb April 10th of 04.
When you see, like, roadside bomb blew up in Baghdad today, what does it make?
Well, it's
what,
just,
what goes through your mind having gone?
It's just another 18-year-old boy that's going to go home disabled and piss his life away drinking beer and doing drugs, and that's it. Like, even if you survive, your life's pretty much over. You're not going to, you're disabled or emotionally, like, it's just another person dead. And how many innocent Iraqis are going to get killed in the, you know, because you get hit by a roadside bomb, you have no idea who did it. There's plenty of people living around there. As you see what's happening, I've been in the same situations. I watched a few of my buddies get hit and die, and there was no one there to take my anger out on. There was no enemy. So we just shot anything we could see. And that's, it's escalation. Afghanistan's going to turn into Iraq. And if we start messing with Iran, Iran's going to turn into another Iraq. You go in there, you occupy, all you're going to do is, for every day you've occupied a country, you're going to create at least 30 people that are going to resist you. Because no one wants to be occupied. I hate Bush, but if Cuba wants to come take us to get rid of Bush, I'm going to fight occupation. there's no occupation that won't be fought.
What do you think about the person who planted it?
You got to think, why are they... did they have plans to attack America? Or do they have plans to attack this person that's riding down the street every day with heavily armed weapons and the person who's blown up half the houses on the street? People just don't wake up and want to go kill people. Pain causes anger. You don't have anger unless you have pain before the anger. And that's what it is. You can only take so much before you turn it into anger. I mean, they shouldn't be killing American soldiers, but if my hometown, if my neighborhood was occupied, if we were constantly getting killed, and every time we fire a weapon or drop a bomb, innocent people die, you're going to fight. And what does it matter to you if they die when you've already lost 5 family members? Their life doesn't mean nothing to you. My parents supported me, and they drove me to Canada through a snowstorm, and we crossed the border. I crossed my driver's license straight into Canada, and told them I was going shopping for a few days. And as soon as I got here, I applied for refugee status and been trying to talk out as much as we can to stop this war. I mean, because when I came to Canada, in another 7 months, my unit was going to deploy back to Iraq. And so I have friends, buddies, they're my brothers. Lots of them went to the other units, but they're all going back to Iraq. And we have to do everything we can to stop it, because only more and more young Americans that want to do good are going to kill innocent people, are going to do these terrible things, commit these atrocities, and more and more innocent Iraqi civilians are going to die.
Have you been in contact with any?
I've been in contact with a few of my buddies. They went on to other units, and all of them were supportive. When we were in Iraq, we all said how crap this war was and how we were doing nothing here but trying to survive. And, you know, I just wasn't some crazy thinking soldier. My fellow soldiers, combat veterans, told me everything that I feel. And we talked about together how we're doing nothing there but trying to stay alive.
So why don't more people fail?
Because a lot of us were selling drugs on the street. If we didn't go to the Army, we were going to go to jail. Mm-hmm. And that was the only way to better our lives. And to leave Guaywa, I gave up $50,000 for college. I gave up my future as a citizen. I gave up everything. I have nothing left but my freedoms and my rights to believe the way I do. But, I mean, every conventional aspect of life we've thrown away to come here. We've given it all up to do what we think is right and what we have to do.
And is that working out?
No, I'm about 3 months away from getting deported. So Canada's not the country I thought it was. I thought it was a peace-loving country, but they have troops in Afghanistan. They want to keep them there for 10 more years. They'd be in Iraq if they were able to. Mm-hmm. But it's not the Canada I thought it was. 10 years of Vietnam. Soldiers got amnesty. Mm-hmm. We didn't win the anti-war movement in the U.S. They got tired of funding the war in Vietnam. It wasn't because of all the people that died. They just got tired of paying for it.
What happens if you get deported?
It's sanctuary. I can claim sanctuary, but might as well go to jail if I'm just going to sit inside a church for the next so many years. I could go to another country, but I barely survived 2 years as a refugee in this country. I don't know if I could go to another country and survive. So it's go to prison, take my time, fight it there, take it right to them. I don't want to be the one to do it, but other soldiers have done it. Maybe it's my time to make a stance with them. And if I believed when I first came to Canada, I could not handle prison from all the nightmares and stress and post everything from the war. There's no way I could go to jail for a year or more. Mm-hmm. Now, I did a year in Iraq. I did a year in Army training. I could go through it, but I don't want to. I don't think I should. I don't think as a 24-year-old kid I should go to jail for not wanting to kill people and sit with murderers, rapists, and people who love to kill people. I don't believe that's... Even if I'm wrong in this, I don't believe 1 to 5 years in prison is what I should fit for not wanting to kill people. My grandpa was my stepdad, his dad was a Vietnam vet. He died at 50. He just... Every other week we'd go bring him a 24-pack of Pepsi. And he would sit in there, he'd smoke weed, drink his Pepsi, and then he died at 50, and that was it. That was the only Vietnam veteran I ever knew, until I came to Canada. I thought that era was gone. There's so many draft dodgers up here living. I meant one in the States that survived after going to Vietnam. And all these guys are flourishing, live, making business, A lot of them have good union jobs, working for the union. They're all doing good, have nice houses, families. I want that life. I don't want the drunk on drugs in my room, pissing away my life, waiting to die, like many Iraq veterans are doing right now.
Why are they talking about deporting you?
My paperwork was done improperly, and they abandoned my refugee claim. And I tried to get it reopened. They denied my appeal to have it reopened. So I have 3 months or so to my deportation papers come in. And I have a sponsorship in process because I was married in February. But the government only has to guarantee that they'll try their best to get my sponsorship completed before my deportation comes through. But they don't have to guarantee. They just have to try. And they've already been trying for the last year or so to deport me. So I doubt they're going to try very hard to get my stuff done.
You married a Canadian?
Yeah, February 13th, married a Canadian.
Male or female?
Female. I thought it would be funny if I married a male just to throw it at him, but it's real marriage. I dated her for a year before we got married.
So it's all because your paperwork was filled out?
It was turned in 3 days late, and I didn't answer a few questions. And so they denied it and said I abandoned my refugee claim. And now they're deporting me. So I've done my PRA, which is a pre-removal risk assessment. And once they turn that back to me and give my deportation papers, it's to wherever's next.
Lance Corporal Christopher Magwai. I was born and raised in Hawaii, on the island of Maui. And I was stationed at 29 Palms, California. I've always wanted to be in the military. And I tried getting to the Army, but because of certain circumstances, I couldn't get in. And I took some college courses, and then I joined the Marine Corps. Just a lifetime goal for me. I was so filled with Fox News and the media that we're getting, and it's just pure propaganda. And I was filled with all that, so the anti-Muslim sentiment was in me. I'm not going to lie about it. You know, that's what we were fed in the U.S. So I fell for it, and I joined up, feeling that I would be patriotic in the time of my country's needs. My position at 29 Palms, our unit goes to Okinawa, Japan. And my unit came back from Okinawa, Japan, and they told us that in September we will be going to Iraq. At that time, we started Mojave Viper training, which is the pre-deployment training for all Marines. And my sergeants took us to the side and talked to about four Marines, our fire team, and told us that if we were to kill a civilian, that we would drop an AK-47 behind his body. He also told us how we can change our MREs, our meals ready to eat, for alcohol, cigarettes, and sometimes sex with the Iraqi children. And me, that just tells me, you know, this guy isn't as honorable as I thought he was. He was supposed to earn his rank of Sergeant of Marines, but apparently he hasn't. And this is the man who was going to lead me into battle. He's also training us to exploit the country that we're supposed to be helping reinforce it so that it can be a stable nation. And after doing some research online, after being stunned by all this, I found out from other media sources other than the U.S. that, in fact, we are the reason that Iraq is unstable. I came across a Jeremy Hinsman's website, first war resistor to come up publicly, and I just came up to Canada right after that.
Those were the voices of some of the U.S. war resistors seeking refugee status in Canada. Thanks to Flux Rostrum and Rochester Indie Media for those interviews.
Good evening. Before I take your questions, let me speak with the American people about the situation in Iraq. This has been tough weeks in that country.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful. And so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people. And neither do we.
Meanwhile, investigative journalist Greg Palast is touring the country to talk about his book Armed Madhouse on the state of the American state. He comes to us courtesy of Mike McCormick in Seattle.
April 27, 2003, call comes in from Washington, D.C. to Saddam's palace. It's ours now, the Saddam Hilton. General Jay Garner's ensconced in the bedroom gets a call. It's Rumsfeld. He'd just arrived hours before into Baghdad. Just arrived. And Rumsfeld says to Garner, you know, in so many words, "Don't unpack, Jack. you're out. And then they savaged this guy in the press. Now, what had he done? Apparently, and the reason I talked to him is that I got a hold of this, okay? I know that the president and the prime minister of Britain have said that there was no plan whatsoever for the oil fields of Iraq before the invasion. Conspiracy theories, they call them, of a plan that Bush had a plan for the oil fields of Iraq before we invaded. And he actually didn't. He had two plans. But BBC said, you better go authenticate this, just because the brown envelope tells you that there's a secret plan, doesn't mean that, you know, you better go out. So I went to General Garner. 3 stars, that's good enough for me. Said, you recognize this? He says, oh yeah. See, what happened was, Garner made a mistake. See, the president had made a speech, appointed Jay Garner, and said that we were bringing democracy to Iraq. They'd be in charge of their own destiny. Democracy to Iraq. So Garner got off the plane in Kuwait, and just as he was about to head off into Baghdad, said, yep, democracy, we're going to have elections within 90 days. Not only that, he said, you know what we're going to do? They asked about the oil. He said, it's their country. And he added, and it's their oil. And got a call from Rumsfeld. Goodbye. See, because the plan says, it may be their country and their oil, but see, the elections and democracy, they didn't want that confused with elections. And see, because the plan, Annex D of the plan, it's 101 pages long, and Annex D required 270 days to sell off all state assets, including privatization of concessions and leases and management contracts of all state assets, which in Iraq is just about the game, especially those in the oil and supporting industries, especially the oil. But you can't do that in 90 days. You need 270 days. You can't elect, because no elected Iraqi government is going to let you sell off their oil, or our oil, which is under their sand, right? Garner made a mistake. I said, so why didn't you impose this plan? He said, well, he told me he thought that the plan, economy plan for Iraq, for the occupation, he said, should be about gathering the harvest, because they're facing starvation, getting the water moving and the electricity turned on. Instead, 101 pages, you should read this thing, it has an income tax cut for the rich of Iraq. A cap on corporate taxes, foreign corporate taxes. Expansion of the copyright laws so that we would no longer be threatened by Baptist copies of Britney Spears' Baby Just One More Time. Or dubs of Windows, Microsoft Windows. It was a Christmas tree for corporate America, it looked like. Who came up with this? Looks like a lot of work it went into it, but whose work, you know? There's something about it that smelled. And I smelled Grover Norquist. Now, Norquist is the copy de copy of corporate lobbyists of America. Every Wednesday, he gets his whole team together, the Christian Coalition and the National Rifle Association. And he represented Microsoft. And he represented American Express, etc. So actually, I went to see Grover. And at his K Street offices, lobby offices. And I said, Grover, what about this appendix, 270 days? What about the elections? He said, and he showed me the copyright law changes. And he showed me the sell-off of the banks. and the income tax cuts. And he said, certain things precede elections. Certain things. Like page 73, the oil. And see, what had happened was, there was no Zarqawi. They weren't throwing flowers, but they had gotten together, the Iraqis, under what Garner called the big tent. He had called them together. Kurds, who knew him for 4 years in the northern zone, where he had brought peace by bringing faction together. The Sunnis, the Shiites, they knew him. And they were ready to take control of their country, hold snap elections, and Garner called for removing American troops out of the cities and out of Iraq into the empty desert. It's their country, he said. Let them choose their leaders. Rumsfeld had a better idea. He held an election too. First, they removed Garner, and they brought in someone who is much more experienced. Not in Iraq, never seen Iraq, but they brought in Paul Jerry Bremer, who is much more experienced because he was the managing director of Kissinger Associates. And so they had an election. One voter, Jerry Bremer, appointed the entire government himself. Order one, de-Ba'athification, which meant, in effect, de-Sunnification. All Sunnis out the door. But in case the Shiites thought that they were going to be in charge, he shut down Shiite newspapers, shut down their mosques, moved troops into Najaf. Some Shiites got upset and shot back. And then, when the Sunnis were removed of all their work and all their jobs, a Sunni from Jordan named Zarqawi said, "We're going after the Shiite snakes." And Garner said, "Let's get them under the tent and talk." But the president wouldn't talk to him. Instead, he got out and said, "Bring them on." So you can't have a war president without a war. On a lighter note, let me show you CNN's balls. The balls that they put on the air after the Ohio vote, after the polls closed at 1:05 a.m. on November 3rd, 04, early in the morning. Polls are closed. These are exit polls asking people who they voted for. And as you see, John Kerry, this is a screenshot that was saved from CNN. John Kerry won among men 51-49%, but among women, Bush lost 47-53%. So Bush was declared the winner. Okay. Well, I was reporting for BBC television, and I'm looking at the numbers, so I, reporting the news, declared the winner. I said, John Kerry won. We had a very long investigative story explaining why Kerry won. And you saw that on your news, right? It was in the New York Times, right? You saw that. They did call me. They called me. They said, "We're investigating theories that Bush didn't win the election." Okay, hey, great. Glad you're on it. They're investigating New York Times on the case. So I said, "Yeah, I have a lot of information if you want." He said, "No, we want to ask you a couple questions." I said, "Shoot. First, are you a sore loser? And the second question, are you a conspiracy nut?" I'm often called a conspiracy nut, which always gets, you know, a laugh from the conspirators. And the third question, well, there was no third question. That was the end of the New York Times interview, and the investigation of the election of 2004 was now complete. The next day, they wrote, I'm not kidding you, they wrote a front page New York Times story. I can't say they ignored the story. And this is the headline: "Internet theories of Bush loss spread by blogs. Easily debunked." Well, since the New York Times didn't have a chance to complete the investigation, I thought I would, for BBC, working with voter action. And so I went back to the balls. And so I thought, okay, Kerry wins among men by 2%, among women by 6%. What is the third sex class that put Bush over the top? And the answer, as it turns out, is the disappeared. The votes that disappeared. Officially, according to Ken Blackwell, Secretary of State of Ohio, 1 George W. Bush won the state of Ohio by 118,000 votes. Not like Kate Harris's 537. 118,000 votes. There you go. Not counting a third of a million votes cast and not counted and votes blocked. 139,127 votes cast and not counted. That ain't nothing. See, we've gone a little Ohio crazy. Let me explain the nasty secret of American democracy. In the year 2004, 3,600,380 ballots were cast and not counted. Not in the United States of America, not the Ukraine, not Uganda. 3.5 million votes. I didn't get this from my black helicopter, okay? I used to teach statistics, and like I said, I worked, you know, with Milton Friedman, and I went into the raw data of the Election Information Agency in the U.S. Census. It's reported there. It's sitting there, as I want to tell the New York Times. It's waiting for you, you know? It's waiting for you. Okay. Where are these from? 3.5 million votes. What happened? They're in two big piles. One pile is something called spoiled ballots. It's one term used in the vote bid. Spoiled. 1,389,231 spoiled ballots. Now, how do ballots spoil? I mean, leave them out of the fridge? Or, no, hanging chads. They hung around from 2000. They kind of multiplied. Hanging chads, lots of them. Punch cards that don't punch. Touch screens that just don't feel like you know how to touch them anymore. In other words, glitches and paper that just, paper ballots that just crumpled, whatever. Glitches, machine glitches. But whose glitches? See, not everyone's ballot glitches the same. That's where the statistics came in. Me and statisticians working with the U.S. Civil Rights Commission and at Ohio State, Cleveland State, we looked at the numbers. And golly gee, look at the electoral dumpster. Where are the votes glitched? If you look at the white precincts, let me show you this little chart here. If you can see, it's also in the book, it'll be easier. Little white lozenge. That's white precinct votes that get glitched, not counted. And this big, thick black line, that's African-American voters' probability that their vote will be lost to a glitch. If you're black, the chance your vote will be lost is 900% higher than if you are white. If you're Hispanic, 500% higher than if you're a white voter. If you're a Native American, about 2,000% higher than if you're white. If you do the numbers, simple arithmetic, 88% of all the votes in the 3.5 million pile garbage can of votes are cast by voters of color. 88%, almost 9 out of 10. Now, I don't know who they voted for. And I'm not saying it's deliberate. Or maybe I am. But I was invited by Holly Jacobson and Voter Action. Your people here decided to do something very smart. not just investigate 2004, but I decided to investigate 2008. And what that means is, where are they going next? They are going west, young man. Florida to Ohio. The new demographic, Hispanics, moving west. Holly Jacobson and her crew invited me to New Mexico. And I thought, what a great idea. What happened there is that in New Mexico, George Bush won by 5,988 votes. Just, and who am I to disagree? But I, as long as you don't count the 34,000 ballots left uncounted, unopened, untouched. But whose votes are these? We don't know. Except that we noticed that if you... Okay, I went to Taos Precinct 13. That's known as the Taos Pueblo. And there are precincts in Native country all over the West where as few as 1 in 10 Natives cast a ballot for president, chose a president. I don't mean that they blew off the race. I mean that they got in their pickup truck or their ponies or whatever they do, and they got showed up at the polls. They waited in line an hour. They went into the polling booth, and they didn't pick a president, and they walked out. That's what the machines say. So I decided to go to Taos Precinct 13 and find out about this. It was massive, like Indian Indecision Day all over the West. Wow. Like maybe a protest or some boycott. So I go in and at the Pueblo and meet with a guy who is, his title is War Chief. Okay, and I say, okay, Chief, so you Indians can't make up your mind? You don't know who to pick for president? And the War Chief said, listen, we know who to pick for president, but we don't pick the machines. And he added something. He said, we trusted them. They came in with the machines and we trusted them. Raises some questions about his knowledge of history. But, okay. See, we don't give them blankets with smallpox. We just give them the old Shootronics machines. You know. So the Republicans know this in advance? Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State of Florida, Ohio, of New Florida, as they call it, wrote to the Republican head of the Senate there before the election, if we don't change the punch card machines, we're going to have a Florida-like calamity in the minority districts. Now, it was not a warning, it was a boast. The ACLU saw what was happening and said, change the machines before the election. This was nearly a year before the election. And Blackwell said, sue me, which they did. And he went to the court and he said, as soon as the trial is over, yes, we are going to change those machines. We'll have the hearings mid-November 2004. 2 weeks after the election. So that's what you had. You had the man in charge of counting the vote, who's also the co-chairman of the Bush for re-election campaign, which is interesting. I mean, in most countries you're not allowed to wear two hats unless you have two heads, so I'm going to check that one out. But don't worry, he's not going to be Secretary of State anymore. He's running for governor, but he'll stay in office long enough to count his own votes this November. But that wouldn't have been enough to do it for George in Ohio. Or New Mexico, or Iowa, or we don't know yet how many states. There's a second big old pile of votes. Votes rejected. Voter votes and the ballots rejected. And a special type of the biggest pile of rejections were in something called provisional ballots. What is that? That's a brand new flavor of voter created for 2004. It was a reaction to what happened in 2000. I did the report for BBC television showing that just before the election, Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush ordered the removal of, it turns out, a total of 94,000 voters from the voter roll. 94,000. But for good reason. They're all felons. Of course, their only crime, apparently, for the majority, was voting while black. It's okay. Jeb actually signed a consent decree with the NAACP, apologized, and said he'd never do it again. He did that a year after the election and before he did it again. But the Congressional Black Caucus got a tape of my broadcast from the BBC, and they played it before the caucus, and they went in enraged and demanded of the Republican Democratic leadership that there be a provision that if you show up at the voting, at your voting station, and your name is not on the list, you've been purged or expunged, that you still get a ballot, provisionally. And if you are a legal voter, if you're a person who has a right to vote, then your ballot gets counted. And then something strange happened. Karl Rove said, "Great idea." Now that was a signal to some of us. And we ought to reconsider, look more closely. But the president signed the law, signed the provisional ballot into law in the 2002 Help Americans Vote Act. Now when George Bush tells us he's going to help us vote, immediately I get concerned, but you know, and sure enough. See, because the president signed the law requiring that all provisional ballots, that you be given a provisional ballot, but there is no provision that the ballot be counted. And that was left up to each Secretary of State, Mr. Blackwell, Ms. Harris. How many provisional ballots? Congressional Black Caucus said, well, looking at the purges, and we stopped the purges, well, you know, maybe we'll get a few thousand ballots. 3 million voters in 2004. 3 million voters were, completely unreported in the U.S. press. 3 million voters, this is the official number, were shunted to provisional ballots. And 1,090,729 voters' ballots were thrown in the garbage. 1.1 million ballots cast, thrown in the garbage. Were these illegal voters? You know, it's a crime. It's a felony in every state in the country to vote illegally. What a crime wave. 1 million people voting who had no right to vote. So I called up all these attorney generals. How many people you bust? Well, none. Florida said, how many cases you got? They said, 6. You mean you brought charges against 6? No, I said, we're looking at 6 cases, but we haven't brought them. The crime that didn't happen, but 1.1 million people punished for it. Which 1.1 million? Any guesses? 88%, right? 88%. But the question was, 3 million? How do you get 3 million provisional voters? That means that someone had to challenge these voters, purge them, challenge them. How could this have possibly happened? And then in my computer, I started getting some emails. They weren't actually addressed to me. We had worked with a website called georgebush.org. And see, there was communications between the chairman of the Republican Party state committees and the Tim Griffin, who is the chief political operative and research director of the Republican National Committee, talking top honcho, sending emails back and forth. And attached to these emails were lists of voters. In fact, see, all their names were in the domain georgewbush.com. And then someone on one email put .org, and we were able to get them all. But, you know, we had a look. What the heck is this? It was like a bunch of names and addresses. But why would the very top level people in the party have a bunch of names and addresses of voters? I mean, you're talking, we had like 70,000 names, and we had to go through these, and we were like bleary. I mean, this is like insane effort to match these names and addresses with maps and demographics. And sure enough, almost every single voter, except for 2%, 98% were in African-American majority precincts. Now, what the heck was this?